Today is December. Today is January 7th. It's 2018. And we have just picked up Winslow Burleson, W-I-N-S-L-O-W, B-U-R-L-E-S-O-N, at Pierce Ferry. Winslow has just completed a two-week Grand Canyon trip. His put-in date was the 18th of 2017. Hazel Clark, H-A-Z-E-L-C-L-A-R-K, and Tom Martin, T-U-M-M-A-R-T-I-N, are the interviewers. And Winslow, how was your trip?
It was great.
Tell me all about it.
Let's see. One of the amazing things about this trip was that having done the similar trip 2 years earlier, it was this mixture of memories from the previous trip and strategies and figuring out what you want to do this trip and what you've done last trip. And so, you know, getting down to the bridge and looking up at the condors, and thinking about where the first night is. Similar both trips, just really needed a day or two of decompression as soon as I got on the water. So got to soap or forget where the first campsite this trip was, but slept most of the second day. So just needed a lot of time to, you know, between getting off work and getting through all the logistics of getting the trip ready, then also a little bit of on the water logistics, just getting some of the food sorted out and final equipment stuff getting ready. Just take that time, take it at an easy pace. If you got time, you might as well use it.
And you had done that the trip before, the first day was launch day, and then second day was sort of your first layover, if you will.
Well, the first trip in January 2016, 2 years ago, it was snowing the day I launched, and it was rainy the second day, and I hadn't figured out much of my food. I had all my food with me, but I didn't understand its portions or allocation. So I split it up into three. I took a little video of me counting out Clif Bars. And, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 in this bin, 7 in that bin, 8 in this bin, and sorting it all through. This trip, it was much nicer, weather starting off. It was still cold the first couple days. I didn't have quite as warm a sleeping bag this time, so that was a factor. I don't know exactly what was going on with the air bladder in the bottom of my ducky, but there was a little concern that it might be leaking, so I was pumping it up a little bit the first couple days, but then it stayed solid the rest of the trip. I didn't want to take it apart and repair it first go, because that would take a lot of effort and be challenging, and so I didn't need to do that, and it turned out fine.
So I forgot to mention, you're all by yourself, and your boat is an inflatable kayak. How long is that boat?
I think it's 14 feet. It's an Airlinks 2.
So it carries
two-passenger
boat?
Yeah, it's a two-passenger boat. I have it rigged with the front seat turned backwards, I think, so that I'm paddling it as a solo.
And the Airlinks, that's A-I-R-E-L-Y-N-X, is that?
Yeah, I believe so.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's a small inflatable kayak. And how many gear bags did you have tied into this thing?
Yeah, so five gear bags, and then a mesh bag and a day bag. So that was, when I was buying the boat before the first trip, I had actually 6 months before the first trip, I'd gone on a group trip with three rafts, three 18 feet, with rented out of Moencobee, and we pulled up to Diamond Creek, and a couple minutes after we got there, engineer from Sacramento pulled up in an Air Lynx 1, and he had his poop tubes hanging out the back with the little screw caps and, you know, all the rest of the logistics that, you know, pretty much the same rig that I have now, in a slightly smaller boat. And he had started his trip with two people, and his buddy had strained his shoulder on the trip and decided to hike out. So he ended the trip single, and that gave me a lot of inspiration and motivation to figure out how to do it solo. And then I read Bruce Klein's book, Never Boat Alone, asterisks unless you've unless you've read this book about solo trips in the Grand Canyon. And then I saw Bruce Klein on the first trip 2 years ago, my first solo trip, which was great. He was riding an Air Cat, so he had also known the president of Air and had taken a picture of our two boats together, two solos meeting up in the canyon, and sent it off to his friend. So that was a fun little meetup. Saw him for about 20-30 minutes. I think it was at Bass. And that was another fun thing about this trip, is since I didn't know the all the campsites the first trip, it was fun to sort of remember and see and get a better orientation to some of the different canyons and features. Obviously, there's so many, it's you know, take a lifetime to learn them all, but it was fun to experience that.
Did you stay in the same camps that you had stayed in 2016?
Now, this trip, I stayed much more on smaller sandbars, and the smaller the site, the better. There were less rodents, and I would get these little mice that would run up and down over the mesh tent that I had, because I was camping backpack style, so I would, you know, crawl in my sleeping bag and set my camp stove outside my tent in my turkey pans. So the first year I had all the gear for having winter fires. I had made this turkey pan based fire pit that was the right size and shape, and engineered that out and had the Kevlar blanket, and never ended up making any fires because I realized I would have to carry all the charcoal out and didn't want to do that either. But, you know, between candles and the camp stove, there's enough yellow flame to enjoy the sentiments of fire. And this time I used many fewer candles because the first time I was finding myself getting sleepy reading by candlelight and thought that was a little dangerous. So I brought more batteries and had the headlamp going. Did a lot of reading in red light just to keep my eyes adjusted so I could look out and see the shooting stars and periods between chapters. And then I enjoyed the sandbars because, you know, the smaller the camp, the less likely there would be mice or ants. And I was able to set up those, you know, find them. Plus, they were there much more often when you needed them. So you didn't have to wait and look as long as you... Sometimes I would go pretty late in the day. I would go from... you know, it start to be 5 o'clock, 5:15, 5:30, 5:45. It's getting pretty dark. You know, 6 is pretty dark. So you don't really want to be, you can't really, it'd be difficult to find a sand bank at 6. And so, you know, if you're starting at 5:15 and looking in an area where there are not too many, I also got to some of the washes that were labeled as campsites and wasn't so convinced that they were, you know, so I didn't find things that I liked at some of the smaller main camps. So I'd go on and find a sandbank. Found a really nice one. I think it was around Ledges, but maybe a couple miles after. And it was up under a little overhang. And I went all the way up, pulled the boat up the bank a little and got up there. It's just big enough for one or maybe two tents, you know, but one tent perfect. Got right in under that little ledge, and it was funny, the crows still found me, the ravens. And so, you know, one of the things Bruce said in his book was that the Park Service assigns two deputized ravens to every boat trip, So these ravens are they're spies that are looking out for solo boaters throughout their navigation of the canyon.
Did they steal anything from you?
The first trip I had ravens because I was keeping in my garbage in my mesh bag, and so the ravens ended up poking a nice big hole in my mesh bag and getting messy stuff there. This trip I did pretty well. I didn't do that, and other than inside used peanut butter jars, so they were probably cleaner and more sealed, so they didn't have as big a impact or an issue with the ravens there. So that worked out pretty well.
Okay, so day two, you just hung out and slept, and then headed on into Marble Gorge, went through the Roaring Twenties. Did you swim in there at all?
I think so. This trip, I was much less worried about swimming and much more confident. In the last trip, I had swum a lot, but since it was my first solo, and first time in the Ducky on rapids, I was, in the Roaring Twenties, I was worried about swimming because I hadn't swum on the water yet. I was very safety conscious and ensuring that everything was properly established in my fanny pack, which I kept on my person all the time, including my satellite beacon, e-perp, but this trip, I had that routine down pretty well, and I was much more confident with being able to just swim, flip over any time. One of the things you and I did at the beginning of the first trip was to test my roll, test the integrity of all the straps and everything with a fully loaded kayak, make sure I knew how to flip it back over. I did that again at the beginning of this trip and was good to go. So another big thing about this trip was having seen a lot of these rapids two times in the last 2.5 years, one on the oars and one on the solo, I was more confident with being able to run them and did less scouting. I was able to see what I needed to from the vantage point of the Ducky. And the Ducky's a lot faster and lighter than a larger boat. And, if it says, be one boat length away from the right wall or from the big hole, in a Ducky, you have, 10 feet, 16 feet, because one boat width of an 18-foot raft is 10 feet. So, you can fit 5 or 6 Duckies in there, so there's a lot more, what's the word?
Room.
A lot more room, but a lot more forgiveness in terms of the, or latitude in terms of how you're doing things. What I experienced was that I was feeling like I was getting the line set up and able to do the runs I wanted to. But, there'd be a randomness in terms of the size of a lateral or the, not necessarily a hole, but just the way a standing wave would set up on you was such that if it crashed at the right time, it would swamp you and flip you. And you're not in a boat that can roll, so you're going to swim. If you stop and scout, you're still going to be in that same spot with that wave, there's not a way to do the timing there. The timing is in the force that you're applying and the energy that you're putting in right in the wave trough right before that wave. So you're doing your best in that moment, but it's not something you can anticipate from the scouting perspective. So I was doing a lot more read and run and feeling good. I ended up swimming in crystal and lava. Last time I was so excited about my solo success in lava. I hit the V wave, got flipped around in the second wave, made it past the cheese grater and stayed afloat and cheered. And that was a real thrill. This time I scouted and set up. It was interesting. I was a little intimidated the first trip. I had scouted, and I was, you know, had this, it was worked up in my mind, you know, psychologically. We had flipped in the, one of the raft trips had flipped in the first trip on the oars in the summer. So it, there's a little bit of intimidation in terms of the power of the rapid there. And then I had been swept out of the boat just around the cheese grater on the in lava. And so somebody jumped on the oars there and pulled me back into the raft. So now my first solo trip, I was up on the ridge, and you know, there wasn't anybody around, and it was time to do the rapid. So I said, okay, I'm gonna get to go do this. And you know, so there was that sort of trepidation or excitement, and I hit the bubble line and made it through as I described and was excited. This trip, I was more confident with the swimming and more confident with the safety factors in terms of having everything that I needed and knowing what to do, and with swimming, actually. So I had swum more, a little more this trip, and a little higher in some of the rapids. And so I just went saying, you know, if I swim, I swim. People swim this, and that'll be okay, too. And there was a lot more sort of acceptance. And that was, you know, both happening on the water, but also just in general of, you know, do what you want to do, enjoy it the way you want to enjoy it, and things will be fine either way, you know.
And you're wearing a dry suit, is that right?
Yes. So I had, forget the name, it's Kotoka?
Kokatat?
Kokatat, dry suit. It's pretty nice.
Kokatat. Kokatat.
Kokatat. So I had the dry suit, I had the dry, the neoprene canyoneering booties. I think those might also be by that company. The suit I had had a hood, an external hood. It's not dry, but it's kind of like a parka. I didn't end up using that this trip, but it was nice to have the first trip. Yeah, it's a pretty nice suit. It's got, you know, the waist zipper to the relief zipper, and then the main zipper. So I'm wearing the dry suit. I'm wearing the life jacket. Have two really nice high-volume life jackets with the head support, so if you're unconscious, they're trying to flip you over and hold your head above water. So those are there. They're bright orange. had a red helmet, NRS helmet. Wore the helmet in all the big rapids, and then also just on some of the other days. Also, nice little neoprene beanie with a sun visor, so that sits under the helmet, and that's good. I didn't actually use any, I think I used sunscreen like one day, but pretty much everything else, I was using the beanie and a large sun hat. Sometimes I put the hat over my helmet even, because I want the safety of the helmet, but then I wouldn't do that in a rapid, but during the long interludes between the rapids, I would use the sun shelter there. But then going back to lava for a second, I'm wearing the life jacket, wearing the dry suit, and get back in the boat, have everything nicely strapped down, and hit the bubble line, hit the first V wave very nicely. As I just described, hit the second wave at a time where it just swamped me, crunched me, turned the boat, and I was over and underwater for a little bit. You know, since I'm wearing the buoyant life jacket, I was able to come back up. I was underwater for a couple seconds, you know, a little longer than I wanted to be, but nothing that was scary. And came up, I would always hold my paddle, but I was a few feet away from the boat. And that's about as far as I ever got away from the boat. So I paddled and swam over to the boat, grabbed it, and was able to get back in it. You know, went through the big wave train, stayed there for a little while. When you're with the boat and it's heavy, you can't really reflip it over in the wave train. You know, you can, but it's jostling around a lot, and it's it can pull on your shoulder, or it can be hard to get up onto, because you stick your knee up on the lower, it's upside down, and there's these handholds, so you grab one of the handholds, and you stick your knee up to your chest, and you use that to flip it back over, and now you're back in the water, because it flipped over, and you have to do a secondary move to thrust yourself back into the boat. So it's easier to do all that when the waves have subsided a little bit. But in both Crystal and Lava, I was able to do that before the second half of the rapids. So getting to the left of the cobble bar and then getting in it before the lower lava. The water was lower this year, and we had talked a little bit about the bedrock and the left run, and it looked so low that it was enticing. I was like, but you're so low, you don't want to do something foolish. And so I was cautious, took the right run, but it was low enough that I was able to see much more of what was going on around the back, and I didn't eddy out at all to really check it out, but I could see that it was really messy and definitely not recommended. Probably not even something you'd want to do if you were in a ducky in a group. Definitely not solo. So now, those are the kinds of thoughts, explorations. We interviewed on the way up here, and you were asking me about the relationship between solo gliding and solo kayaking, because I had done a student pilot's license and gotten to the solo. And, that's the kind of thing, where in the gliding, I was on my first solo, and I said, oh, maybe I'll do a little circle here to work off some altitude, and thought very quickly that, no, I should do exactly what I've been taught to do and get down safely on my first solo. And that's the same kind of reasoning that is brought to the the kind of decision that I just described in making the, sticking with the plan of the right side of bedrock.
Did you interface with other trips? I know that there was a trip that launched a day ahead of you, and actually they were leaving when you were at the ramp, and you had a chance to go talk to them and tell them you were coming in behind them. When did you first see people on the water?
Yeah, so this trip, I saw maybe 5 or 6 other trips. There's 2 or 3 kayak trips, some with sea kayaks, some with a group of river kayaks. There were 2 raft trips, so at least 4 trips. And there was the group you just described. Some of them were from Colorado, I think others maybe Arizona. They had, 5 people, 4 people? 2 single rafts and a couple, I think a total of 4 people. And so I was at Bass, and I saw their rafts at Bass Camp. I wanted to hike up to the camp because I hadn't been up there yet. And I decided I would stay at the Upper Bass camp, the little pre-Bass spot. And I didn't really want to see anybody at that time in the trip. I wanted to, and I'd also decided that even at Phantom, unlike my first trip where I stopped and had dinner and breakfast, I also wanted to not see people or not interact with people. Just wanted to have the kind of quiet time and space solo for that duration. I'd really enjoyed the last 10 days of my first trip where I hadn't seen anybody for that entire time. One of the things about the space out there is that you're on the river, so there can, there's always a chance that somebody might come around. You're showering, and oh, maybe somebody's going to come, or there's always a little bit of anticipation, but for the most part, you're very alone, and that there's the safety factor of if you lose your boat, or if you need to get some help, you can hang out for a day or two, and there'll likely be somebody that shows up for a little while. But the first time I saw people this trip was at the Bass place, but I avoided them there. I took an alternate route back to the Bass camp, but ended up seeing them on the trail anyway. So I spent about 10-15 minutes talking to them at that point. And then even at Phantom prior to that, had seen a bunch of people, but stayed far left and not really interacted with anybody on the river beach or the upper bridge. But then there was a couple walking across the lower bridge, and you know, it was kind of too obvious they were right above me. I waved at them, and you know, but so that was pretty much, those two were the first interactions with other people throughout that experience. And then I did see different groups, maybe at Christmas Tree Cave, and but I would continue past. It was an interesting psychological thing. Somebody at Christmas Tree Camp, you know, saw me with the solo and said, "Oh, that's badass." And then, you know, that even just a comment like that, because that was the first comment in, you know, other than that 10 minutes of talking to somebody, you know, it filters with you for the rest of the day, day and a half. You know, it's there every hour or two or something of, you know, and so it's an interesting, you know, feedback loop in terms of how these things affect you. And so a little bit later, down around mile 209, 210, it was the first day that the river got more silty, and I had been filling from the river to treat the water and use it. And so I ended up deciding that if I saw a group, I would stop and ask for some water, just so I had enough and didn't have to spend the extra time to get ready at camp and stuff. And at that point, I found a group of, I think they had three rafts, three couples, and a friend, so seven people, from the Northwest Territories above the Arctic Circle. And they were there for, they were taking out at Diamond Creek. So it was the end of their trip and close to the end of my trip. And I spent about an hour and a half with them, had a couple of liters of water and a beer, and enjoyed the from 3 o'clock to 4:30. I got back on the water at 4:30 and paddled on for another hour and a half, almost to 6, found a little site. So those were my major experiences with people. There was a couple people over at the helicopter landing sites in the lower post Diamond Creek takeout, and it was interesting because I didn't see anybody, but I heard some voices, and I didn't expect to hear any voices. I expected to hear helicopters, and I hadn't heard any helicopters, so I just heard these voices all of a sudden. I saw some shadows because it was later in the day up on the ridge, and two or three of them were moving and two or three of them weren't, and so I figured out that there was at least two people up there, and they were the ones that I'd heard. Then I realized a third person who hadn't been moving started to move. There was an umbrella, and then there was the tail fins of a helicopter. And so I said, "Oh, that is the helicopter, and that's why they're there." And you know, I waved at them a couple times. Shortly thereafter, there was what you describe in your river guide, the ride of the Valkyries. There was a, you know, series of 8 or 10 of these little helicopters coming in, all low flying. I didn't know that they were allowed to fly that low, and they were coming in right over me. Turned out they were landing the river left just beyond where I was, and just one after the other, every minute or two, that was quite an experience.
What are your thoughts about the helicopter development in the Western Grand Canyon?
I guess I would say I don't know a lot about the history of the development or the number. I just had that experience that I just described. I know in Manhattan, shortly after my first trip, there was an article in the New York Times around the impact of the noise on the city, of the amount of helicopter activity, in particular relative to the number of people that benefit from it. So, you know, there's a very small number of tourists, individuals who are getting short, brief experiences in these machines, and then there's a huge impact on the rest of the environment or the people. So, you know, I think there needs to be consideration of the intensity of these things. I mean, one of the things that is also from an ecological, environmental perspective, even you know, an individual out in these environments is having a big impact. Alone, without a machine, you know, just being there, you know, starting a fire or creating the smell of the food that you've cooked, or and then sometimes the more remote and even solo individuals are going a little further than others, and so they're impacting areas that are not as often visited, and so there's arguments across the spectrum of what level of impact these different activities have. Obviously, you know, helicopters have even a much higher impact than planes. You know, they're louder, they're landing in the canyon, they're getting all the way down to close to river level. You know, so unlike being up in the sky and flying over, you're really getting a lot more impact from these machines. And, you know, my experience here was that they were going all the way till it was after sunset. It was, you know, a cloudy, cold day, and it was 5:30, 6 p.m. before they were stopping. And then 7:35 this morning, the first one flew through and was there again. And, you know, since then, every you know, 15 minutes or so, there was another helicopter in the entire region from, you know, 260 to 280. So you're talking about a huge area and a very intense amount of activity. You know, it's not isolated to a certain time of day or a certain number of flights. You know, it doesn't appear to be, at least. So,
what would you do differently on your next trip?
Yeah, I mean, I think each time, we'll see how this works. The first time I got off the first solo trip and, you know, wanted to have more climbing experience and more hiking fitness, and, you know, started to explore some of those in the 2 years between the trips. This time, I had a little bit of a heel spur that prevented me from extended backcountry hiking. So I think one of the things would be to spend more of the time, more of the layovers and more of the, you know, it's the same answer for both trips. More hiking, more of the side canyons. The first trip, one of the things I wanted to do differently was the food. I had picked up a couple meals that were ready to eat and hadn't pre-tested them, so I had a lot of these kind of spicy, not freeze-dried, but, you know, essentially dry-pack grocery store foods, and hadn't eaten them before, so they were not to my liking, and I had too many of them, so that was a little onerous. This time, I did better on the food. I did a lot more Cliff Bars and skipped lunches in favor of just sort of on the water eating and nibbling. You know, you could have snack packs or Cliff Bars, different ways to do that. But that meant that I just had breakfast and dinner. There was still some fine-tuning that I would do there. I still haven't done much artwork on either trip. I did a lot more journaling this trip, which was very reflective. I did a lot of reading. The first trip, I did a lot of reading on philosophy. It was kind of the meta general understanding of our place in the world and our way of being in the world. This trip, it was, I would say, more applied philosophy. So it was, you know, more about your experience. I read a book called Small is Beautiful, Economics as if Humans Matter. And so that was an interesting perspective in the 70s about the population impact and the energy impact, fossil fuels that we were having on the world as a civilization, and how really that had only occurred over the previous 3 to 5 decades. And so that there's this huge ramping up of the impact of the Industrial Revolution, and unclear how that could be sustained over the next 50 years, which brings us to today, essentially, 2020 or 2018. And so it's interesting to see that kind of historical perspective of where some of those concerns are valid and where they aren't, and what are some of our continuing impact is. I also read Siddhartha on both trips, which is a great book about sort of personal meditative philosophy, and has a lot to do with rivers in terms of gaining wisdom and experience from reflecting on nature and the role of the river. So that was another wonderful experience. Going into this one, I brought some poetry and music theory, and I read most of the poetry in the context of what I just talked about in terms of place in the world and perspective on nature and meaning and experience, and so those were very meaningful. And I did a lot of journaling, but I think I would like to do a little bit more artistic creative generation. So in terms of either building up some skills to maybe write some music, or doing more painting. One thing I did do this trip, I did this fall take a couple, join a couple choirs at NYU and New York University. And so I was bringing to the canyon a little bit of voice experience and was able to explore some of that in the canyon. So in terms of the music theory and the poetry and what little pieces of songs that I remembered, I was able to explore both my voice, but also my voice in the context of the nature and the echo chambers and some of the spaces. So I think one answer to your question is how, over the next time frame, I may mature or develop some of those skills even further and appreciate them. I was paying a lot of attention to sounds in the canyon and listening to some of the birds, and had a nice little interactive whistling experience with a couple of the different birds along the shore, those were magical. Just in terms of nature, I saw quite a few condors throughout the canyon, very high up, soaring, and enjoyed experiencing their flight. When I had been flying, we had circled with 6 or 7 hawks in Vermont, and so having that personal experience of being up there in the thermals, what I brought to the canyon, and appreciated seeing that here in the canyon in terms of the condors, appreciating some of that soaring experience vicariously through these very massive large wingspan birds. And
what worked for you that you would do again?
For me, I found that doing longer days and then having days off and interspersing was something I needed, just in terms of the energy that it took one day to get up and out and packed and ready and on the water. It was worth spending, if it's 3 o'clock, to me it was worth spending, another 1, 2, 2.5, maybe even 3 hours on the water, get in another 5-10 miles, and then have a full day off. you know, I spent a lot of that time reading, and I was balancing, you know, the experience on the water and the moving forward in the trip with my interests in some of the different books that I had brought, and what I would be learning from those, and how I would reflect with that knowledge and experience on, you know, while I was on the water. So there was this balance between reading one day and being on the water one day, and reading and being on the water, and integrating those two pieces was helpful and important to me. There would be kind of a saturation of one and then the other, you know, so I'd kind of overdose on maybe a little too much reading or relaxing, or laying in the tent too long, you know, the intensity of being on the water and that full day of activity. You know, so that worked both intellectually or spiritually, but then also physically, you know, giving my shoulder a chance to rest, or I had a little bit of, you know, fatigue in my shoulder once or twice or a couple days throughout the trip, so I would want to take a day off just to pace it. So that was a piece of things as well. But just being okay with that, understanding that you know, that's what I needed. And other things that worked, I mean, I think the food preparation, just having those pans and the non-sandy spot, you know, where you can cook. The logistics, I was just very familiar with being able to put on the dry suit, get everything all packed and ready. It still takes forever. It takes... you know, I'd get up at 6:45, 7, 7:30, 8, whatever time I would wake up, usually between 6:30 and 8 and 7:30. And then I wouldn't get on the water until 9:30 or 10, sometimes even 10:30, in terms of breakfast, using the bathroom, getting everything into the bags, packed, strapped, getting the cliff bars into the pack, reading the rapids so I knew what was coming up, reading the possible sites that I would potentially want to hike or camp at so I knew what some of the options were. So all of that was stuff that you're either doing on your down day or you're doing that morning. And then sometimes it's a little overwhelming, so you're like, oh, I'll just read another chapter of something relaxing. So that adds another half hour to the prep time. And then you still get on the water and go for a while. I think another, you know, just being quiet and silent and floating. So sometimes not paddling and just, or minimally paddling, was another significant experience. Just being able to float there and try to be, you know, meditative or as present and as possible with the different parts of the canyon, thinking of, well, this is the river, but, you know, the canyon is the river. You know, where does the river stop? Are the clouds part of the river? Are the are the rocks part of the river? You know, when are they part of the river? When are they not part of the river? And just embracing kind of the spectrum or wholeness of that experience, that it's all part of the same thing, and that you're present at that time.
Would you do it again?
I think what I learned the first trip, I mean, I'll be interested to see this trip. The first trip, there was a major feeling of accomplishment and stretching. Of this was something I wasn't sure about, that I was, stretching in terms of, oh, this is a solo trip. I've never been alone that long. This trip was a repetition, and I think it then allowed me to go kind of deeper into some of the journaling and the perspective, and be a little more relaxed about the trip, and a little more confident in the trip. So, you know, a little bit more attention to some of those personal experiences in terms of the singing or the interaction with nature. You know, and I think for me that I'm finding that's a very healthy and necessary experience. There's a huge juxtaposition between, you know, the number of people you see in 20-day period in the Grand Canyon and the number of people you see in a 20-minute period in Manhattan. So, you know, that I think is you know, part of the need to come out here and you know, be alone and reflect. I think another piece of it was it was interesting to see the sort of waves of experiencing temporally this trip. You know, you'd go a few days and you'd say, okay, I'm starting to relax or decompress, or I needed that first day to sleep and just, you know, get resituated. After 5-6 days, you're thinking less about the past or what you brought with you and more about where you are and where you're going. But it's all there and it's all feeding back. So, you know, there's this mix of, oh, what, you know, what's it going to be like when I'm done? And you know, is it going to be done? Or how much longer is this going to be? You know, I think on a solo trip, you haven't seen anybody. So there's moments where you're anticipating or in some way needing or wanting to be back with friends or you know, in day-to-day experience. But those are short-lived relative to the experience of being out there and things that you want to focus on becoming... I guess what I was surprised by this trip was how every couple days I would gain new insights on new topics. So, you know, sometimes it would be about the kind of work that I want to be doing, or sometimes it would be the kinds of adventures I want to be taking, or the kinds of friendships that I want to be developing. And, you know, I would think that I'd covered a lot of it after the first 10 days. And I was like, oh, it's, you know, I still have 10 days. Oh my gosh. You know, but after 12 days, you're like, oh wow, those 2 days were really valuable. You know, and then after 17 days, you're still, you know, still have 4 days left, or, you know, and 3-4 days, and you're like, oh my gosh, this is still happening. I'm still here. And then, but at the same time, there's, you know, things that you're writing or coming up with that are valuable and insightful and feel like I will take forward in terms of how I will think about what I want to do over the next 6 months to a year. And so, I don't know. You know, obviously, if I was on the water for another week, that probably would still happen. You know, yeah. You know, we'll see how... I guess, you know, part of that question is how long do these things need to be and how often do they need to be? And that, I think, is a big part of your question. And then how do you integrate them better? How do you understand more about how your everyday life encompasses enough of what you need?
What are you going to take back to the classroom from this trip?
Oh, yeah. So many different things. I mean, I do a lot of creative work, a lot of invention and design. And so, you know, a lot of the time out there, you're thinking about different things that that are could be done better. You know, simple things like maybe, you know, instead of putting the 2 iodine tablets and then the next iodine tablet in, could it all just be in a gel capsule and you just drop it in once? You know, also the need to relieve yourself frequently. You know, is there a catheter or some other type? You know, so I work in the College of Nursing, so there's needs, you know, are there technologies of how you can have a type of catheter tube that might be more comfortable on insertion and then be less painful as it comes out? Or is that the kind of technology that can be used outside of a medical context in an adventure context, you know, in a underwater habitat or in a dry suit? You know, so other thoughts are, you know, how can that place, how can the canyon and the national parks and you know, some of these places be classrooms themselves, you know, and in what contexts and structures can that happen? So, you know, taking things back to the classroom is one direction. You know, a very simple, literal version of that is I've been looking at how to get enough people to enroll in my class this spring, and there's scheduling issues. But there was this experience that, if I hold classes on Saturday, there's much more possibility of having more people take these classes. And so, you know, going into the canyon, I hadn't thought that that was something I wanted to do. But as I was in the canyon, I saw new structures about how that could happen. You know, doing 3, 4, 5 day, 5 Saturdays across the semester for longer workshops could work really well. So, you know, there's this back and flow of the kind of literal specific to the design engineering to even the topics that you want to do classes on. Like, do you want to do, citizen science and adventure ecology or leadership and teamwork? How many different kinds of classes could you teach in a month on a month-long canyon trip? So a lot of different perspectives on education and experience.
What else would you like to add that we haven't covered yet?
I just think two things. I think I said something similar at the end of the first solo. One is that when you have a goal or an ambition or objective like this, it's very impressive and gratifying that the various people that make it possible with you are able to do that. And that couples to the second thing, which is the encouragement to anybody to do this. If you have an aspiration or an objective to get on the water, to hike down to the river, to get off the rim, even just a few minutes down a trail, is much more impactful than staying at the lodge. the importance of going beyond your own ability and doing it to fulfill your aspirations and goals. I think those two parts. One is that knowing that that's an important part of life, being able to stretch yourself and build these new experiences, and that there's a community and people willing and ready to help you make that possible, are the two parts that I think resonates as I came off all of the different trips that I've been on, these last two solo trips in particular.
Yeah, I would think that that's as good today as it would be 50 years from now. Get out there and do it. Nice. Well, this would then complete part two of an interview with Winslow Burleson at the takeout on the drive back to civilization here on the 7th of January, 2018. Thank you very much.